The Ulster Economics Podcast. The podcast that keeps you up to date with what is happening economy-wise in Northern Ireland. Telling you what you need to know, but not necessarily what you want to hear. It is better to be prepared for the economic environment we're operating in and not the world we would like to be in. Episode 25, Unhappy Anniversary with Mark McGill. Well, it's podcast time again, and I'm delighted to be joined by Ulster University's Economic Policy Centre's senior economist, Mark McGill, who is the guru on labour market data. Good morning, Mark.
Oh, thanks, Richard. Thanks for the invite. Happy to be here.
And how is the cost of living crisis treating you?
It wasn't treating me too well the other day when I had to pay £6.50 for a pint of beer, or £7 for my favourite packet of pistachio nuts. Those two things weren't particularly treating me too well.
Yes, I've noticed it's on the ice cream and baked beans front. It's now for a well-known brand of baked beans, £4.15 for a four-pack, which is soared. And there's also, in Ballyhackamore, there's people in the know will know where there's certain ice cream shops. And they did have a £10 tub, which is 8 scoops, in case you're wondering. It's recently been increased by 10% to £11. So, yep, things are on the up.
I guess you'd really have to love ice cream to pay those prices.
And it's also in terms of utility bills and some of the like mobile phone operators, you were saying there earlier, what's in store next month?
Yeah, a lot of friends have been screenshotting me texts from that they've received from their broadband providers, their mobile phone providers, saying that their bills are going to be going up by the retail price index plus 3.5%. Which the retail price index is currently running around 13.5% in and around that region. It's actually an index that no longer gets classified as a national statistic, so you're recommended not to use it by the Office for National Statistics because it overstates the rate of inflation. So it's interesting to see that seems to be the go-to rate that people are using in order to justify price rises.
Yep, so listeners, be warned if you get those chunky increases in your in your utility bills or your mobile phone bills, it's all down to RPI. So in a short time, Mark and I will then discuss some of the labour market issues going on. But I suppose in terms of just thinking back, this theme of unhappy anniversary, over recent weeks, a few anniversaries have passed by with little fanfare. On the 31st of January, Brexit turned 3 years old. Meanwhile, 2 years have elapsed since the UK left the single market, and even the staunchest supporter of Brexit would be hard-pressed to point to the positives of leaving the EU thus far. A recent poll conducted by Ipsos finds that 45% of the UK public think Brexit is going worse than expected. Another poll by Unheard Britain found that the Boston and Skegness constituency was the only constituency in the UK not to regret leaving the EU. And of course, disquiet with the Northern Ireland Protocol continues to rumble on, and that's despite the UK Supreme Court ruling that the Northern Ireland Protocol is lawful. Lawful but awful is how many in unionist quarters see it. And legal objections may have disappeared, but political objections remain. But will the new protocol deal, which we're expecting today on the 27th of February, will these soothe some of these concerns? Earlier this month, we also passed the one-year anniversary of No Northern Ireland Executive. In the absence of pulling a political rabbit out of the hat, we look set to mark the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement with a dormant stormont. Or will we? Not a good look given the evolving cost of living and NHS crises alongside a ballooning fiscal black hole. But things could be worse. At least we're not at war. And last week, the Russian-Ukraine conflict passed its first anniversary, and developments in Eastern Europe have played a large part in the surge in inflation and by extension the misery that households have experienced over the last 12 months. The Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee has responded with the largest interest rate hikes in the MPC's near 26-year history, and having started last year at just 0.25%, the bank rate has been raised to a 15-year high of 4%. New forecasts anticipate inflation will ease quickly from the 10.1 annual rate in January to between 3% and 4% by the end of 2023. And next year, they're going to expect it to fall significantly below the 2% target. Fortunately, the Bank of England's latest forecast came with two sources of hope. First, there were some clearer signs that the bank is approaching the end of the tightening cycle. Andrew Bailey may get one more hike in to 4.25% before hitting his third anniversary of being governor in March. And second, there was a slightly rosier outlook, namely a shallower recession and a less sluggish recovery than was forecast in November. But it's still set to be distinctly a challenging year, but it counts as good news for now. What was concerning was buried within the Bank of England forecast is the estimated potential supply growth of the UK economy. So that's the potential for economic growth or GDP growth. Over the decade from 1997 to 2007, the potential growth rate in the UK averaged 2.7%. Then from the period 2010 to 2019, it fell to 1.7%. And now the Bank of England expect it to fall further to just 0.7% in 2024 and 2025. Two factors are behind this: productivity and labour supply growth. And it is the latter that we're going to explore today with Mark McGill. Okay, Mark, so one area of the economy that is, you could argue, has had a happy anniversary, whether it's over 1, 2, or 3 years, has been the labour market. A record number of employees on the HMRC payrolls and unemployment close to record lows. What's not to like? So how would you describe the local labour market at the minute?
I think I would describe it in three themes. Number one, the labour market still in recovery mode. While the HMRC series on employee jobs is at record highs, in total employment terms, when we count everybody that works, including self-employed people, we're still below where we were pre-pandemic. Roughly, we're in and around 10,000 people below. So most sectors are still trying to build back to the point of where the size of their workforces before the pandemic. I'd also describe the labour market as extremely tight. We have an unemployment rate of 2.5%. We've very rarely ever had a lower unemployment rate than this. I think since the series began in 1992, there's only been 5 months where we've had a lower unemployment rate than that. So there's very little spare labour about. In terms of the absolute number of unemployed people, it's in and around 22,000 people, which is very, very low. And finally, I would use, in terms of themes, I would say structural is a big issue, in that many of the structural issues which characterised the Northern Ireland economy before the pandemic still characterise the economy now, in particular our very high economic inactivity rate, where we have the highest economic inactivity rate of any UK region, and we've topped that particular league table for most of the past 30 years.
Okay, and I suppose one of the things while we currently we're grappling with cucumber and tomato shortages and outages and all the various supply disruptions that we're seeing on our for our five a day, and any salad dodgers out there are probably unaffected by that. But the big disruption that we're seeing is in terms of labour supply and the shortage of vacancy, or the shortage of skills and the number of vacancies. And basically we're in the midst of an output recession, yet employers are struggling for staff. So that's not normal. So, Mark, where have all the workers gone?
Part of it is just our demographics having caught up with us. It's largely an issue that we've sort of not paid too much attention to over recent decades. But to put it in context for the folks listening to this, if we look at what we call the working age population, which is people aged 16 to 64, That group of people grew, if we look at the 1980s, the 1990s, the 2000s, on average that grew at about 90,000 per decade. In the 2010s, it only grew by 15,000. So our demographic dividend really ended more than a decade ago. And looking forward through this decade, in 10 years' time, our working age population is going to be largely the same size as it is today. One might ask why we didn't notice these type of labour shortages in the 2010s. When our working age population growth grew significantly from what we'd been used to in the past. And the reason is just we'd come out of the global financial crisis at the end of the 2000s. We then moved into austerity. There were some big groups in the labour market that had quite a low employment rate, so there was a lot of labour market slack. So it really took us to a point where you got to very high employment rates, little spare capacity, and then your working age population was no longer growing. And then we really started to feel the bite of labour shortages.
So we really should have seen some of this labour shortages coming, but it's just been obscured by financial crisis and then again by the pandemic.
Yeah, with demographics, they're very long run, slow moving trends, and anything which is very slow moving like that does tend to get ignored by what is sort of more dominant subjects in the news cycle.
And I suppose we've had since 2016, because we've had Brexit, and one of the pools of labour that Northern Ireland economy has benefited from, some sectors more than others, has been the Eastern Europeans from the accession of the EU economies into the EU back in the noughties, sort of around about 2004. So are we seeing at the minute, in terms of Brexit, how is that impacting on the supply of labour from the rest of the EU?
Yeah, unfortunately, there's only some bits of data that are available to us on this issue. One of the main ones, it relates to national insurance registrations. So people who come to the UK, come to Northern Ireland, who to live and work, have to apply for a national insurance number. And we have the numbers on that in the time series, and we sort of averaged in and around 17,000 people per year were coming in and registering in Northern Ireland to work with a new national insurance number. Over the pandemic, that fell off a cliff, where very, very few new national insurance numbers were registered. And I think that's largely a pandemic effect rather than a Brexit effect. But when we get the next point of data for that series, it'll be a new point of data with a new migration regime. And whether we bounce back to 17,000 per year is hugely uncertain. Another source of data we have is from a data source called the Annual Population Survey. And what it's telling us is that there has been a fall in the number of EU nationals really over the last couple of years since 2017. But there has been an increase in the number of non-EU nationals coming to Northern Ireland. But that increase is not enough to compensate for the fall in EU nationals. So we've had a fall in foreign workers coming to Northern Ireland overall.
So basically we've gone from a stage where employers such as the NHS or care homes or business have been able to tap into EU nationals, but now that kind of source of labour isn't. Certainly, while we haven't got exact clarity on what it's like, they certainly aren't coming in the numbers that they came before, and therefore you're going to see that businesses, employers are going to have to look elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, if you think of it like a numbers game in terms of your population, I mean, you can't really do anything about your national increase. But in terms of migration, it's the tool you have in order to provide a short, sharp boost to your labour supply. And, you know, if we don't have the same ability to do that in the past, that's going to dampen those sectors that were more dependent upon migrant labour than others.
Perhaps, Mark, you could just unpack some of the skills problems faced by different sectors, because not all sectors are experiencing the same problems. It's more acute in some areas relative to the others. So if you could just expand on that.
Yeah, I think if we split the economy up into retail, hospitality, so your consumer-facing services, construction, manufacturing and production, and your professional services. So taking the first, if we look at retail hospitality, that's a sector that was very dependent upon a young age profile coming to work in those sectors who are able to work on a flexible hours basis. Now, what we've seen over the pandemic with those groups is that a large part of the increase in economic activity recorded over the pandemic was amongst people aged 16 to 24. In fact, it increased by around 26,000 at peak. So that's a big dent for those types of firms that are reliant upon flexible labour. Thankfully, in the last 12 months, that started to come back. So I think firms in the retail hospitality sector that are targeting young people to work in their sector should hopefully start to see some of those pressures ease going forward. In terms of production, in terms of construction, manufacturing, I think those are longer term trends. I think they're related to trends in academic achievement, where we have now, of everybody that's in school, more than half of them will end up in university. You know, when you have a finite number of young people, that means less people that are there to do professional and technical type courses, who then feed the supply into sectors like construction and manufacturing. Those sectors also typically have slightly older workforce. So when you have a slightly older workforce, that means your demand is going to be slightly higher because you need to replace the retiring workers. So you have sort of those two effects there. And in terms of professional services and IT, you have very fast growing sectors that are reliant upon a strong pipeline of labour. So it just creates intense competition for highly skilled labour going forward. And also because those types of sectors are relatively new in Northern Ireland, you know, they haven't been around for many decades. There's a shortage of sort of management level staff that are available to fill some of those types of roles. So that creates intense competition.
And it's almost one of the legacies of the construction downturn and property crash that Northern Ireland saw was then in terms of the construction industry, where you then have, after the downturn and property crash, you then had fewer younger individuals going into that sector. And that's now sort of feeding through that you're now having, it's like an aging construction workforce, and you haven't had that pipeline feeding through. Okay, so Northern Ireland has one of the lowest unemployment rates, but it traditionally has had the highest economic inactivity rates within the UK, and you alluded to that earlier. And of course, for listeners, inactivity refers to those individuals neither in work or looking for work for a variety of reasons. Can you just sort of unpack what is going on with economic inactivity in Northern Ireland at the minute?
Yeah, it's perhaps best to start with long-term sickness, which is the largest component of economic inactivity. In Northern Ireland, of our working age population, around 11% of people are economically inactive due to long-term sickness. The equivalent figure in the UK is around 6%. So you're almost as likely to be, you're almost twice as likely to be long-term sick due to economic inactivity in Northern Ireland as you are in the UK.
Traditionally, one of the arguments advanced for Northern Ireland's higher levels of long-term sickness has been the legacy of the Troubles and how that's impacted, not least in terms of mental health.
Yeah, that's certainly one reason. Our industrial structure is probably another reason that we had a big manufacturing sector, which has declined, of course, yeah, over a long period of time. And many of the people here economically inactive tended to be victims of economic decline that perhaps wasn't managed particularly well. And in more recent times, rising mental health, particularly among young people, also contributes to some of that rising long-term sickness. Another contributor to Northern Ireland's rising long-term sickness is worth mentioning is our very high health waiting lists. You know, recent figures that came out last week indicated that there are 378,500 people currently waiting on a first appointment, first outpatient appointment on an NHS waiting list in Northern Ireland. Now that, we have to think about our health policy and our labour market policy as not being divorced from one another. As those waiting lists continue to increase, that's going to be a higher proportion of people then who are going to be unable to work because they're waiting on an operation or to receive some other form of treatment that's going to facilitate their return to the labour market. So waiting lists at this sort of magnitude that we currently have are currently not helping what is a long-term structural problem in Northern Ireland.
What about in terms of early retirement? I know there's been talk in the UK that that's been one of the factors behind the 500,000 people who have left the workforce since the pandemic.
Yeah, we're very different from what's happening in the UK with regards to retirement. If we take out people who naturally retire, you know, who just fall into that over 65 age bracket, most of the increase in economic inactivity in the UK is amongst that 50 to 64 age group. I guess it's not a surprise, you know, if you tell people, say, who are in their early 60s to not go to work for a couple of years and then expect them to return, it's not really a massive surprise that they don't want to go back. But in Northern Ireland, our 50 to 64 economic inactivity is only marginally higher than it was during the pandemic. So we haven't experienced the same features with early retirement that the UK has.
Yeah, there's probably a couple of factors help contribute to that. One is the preponderance of private sector defined benefit schemes, that there will be a higher concentration of those, which allows people in that 50 to 64 age group to retire or take advantage of their pension freedoms of retiring at the likes of 55. And then the other one is the equity within their homes, and they, particularly if it's in London, the South East, the higher house prices and the higher levels of equity and wealth there. Just turning to the kind of earnings and wages, what's been happening on the pay front in Northern Ireland?
We've been getting fairly high nominal pay increases, although I would say the data is quite erratic. You know, if you look at mid last year, the annual percentage nominal pay rise was about 8.4%. The latest number in January is about 3.9, turning around that number. So, you know, it's quite volatile, but And while the nominal increases are high, they're still not keeping up with the pace of inflation, meaning that really we're all still taking a pay cut in real terms. I think based on the latest figures, it works out that we've really lost about the last 2 years of wage growth that's been eaten away by inflation.
Yep. And Northern Ireland has seen, based on those January figures, it would have been the weakest real terms wage increases of all 12 UK regions.
It is for the January month. As I say, the data can be slightly volatile, so it might not be the worst by the time we get to next month. But when you try to explain that, I think structure is probably a good explanation of it, with a higher public sector, which are currently going through wage settlements and negotiations at the moment. Then that probably is part of the reason why we have experienced slightly slower nominal wage growth compared to other parts of the UK.
Suppose looking at sort of like looking beyond pay and then what firms are actually doing or employers are doing to try and attract staff. I was struck by it was a couple of weeks ago when I was in Cookstown, going into Cookstown, and there was like one of those electronic kind of construction roadworks kind of signs with saying. It's going to be a careers fair. I think it was like Terex or something like that advertised. So I've never seen that before. And for any listeners, that was situated at the end of the dual carriageway near what used to be the Welcome to Cookstown flower bed, and which was something I was involved in the early 1990s as a summer job. And my job invariably was on a Monday morning to go to that flower bed and replant the flowers in the second letter O, which had been removed by some joker during high spirits over the weekend. And yes, and it's no surprise then that due to a war of attrition, that flower bed had to be removed altogether. But employers are actively trying to do things differently in a way that I've never seen before. And sort of beyond pay, what are employers doing to try and attract staff?
Yeah, I mean, seeing you know advertisements like that for job fairs, it's not surprising given just how intense the competition is. I think the latest survey results from the NI Chamber of Commerce are indicating that 90% of firms in their survey are indicating that they are currently experiencing recruitment difficulties. So what that's telling us is, you know, your first route is to go to pay, but eventually you can only offer pay rises so much before it becomes unsustainable and you have to look at other means. So you start to see an offering of wider, softer benefits, you know, the offering of making the option of hybrid working being almost a right with many job offers that are there. You know, employees certainly seem to value that. So if you're competing against other rival firms and your firm doesn't offer it and the other firm does, you're at a disadvantage. So you're starting to see more of that, more hybrid working in the job advertisements themselves.
It's like a flexibility arms race almost, and particularly in IT, if firms do not offer full working from home, people go elsewhere.
Yeah, we are. We're also starting to see people widening their access pool as well by dropping the entrance requirements required to be able to apply for certain types of jobs. I mean, whenever I was in a previous job working in the private sector, we did this ourselves. Now, we used to have in the advertisement that you had to have an economics degree to come and work in the firm that I was working at the time. And then we changed that to say a degree where economics is a component, because recognizing that there are many other degrees where people did things similar to economics with similar skill sets, and we were able to recruit people then from different types of degree subjects and we wouldn't have done in the past. I think what we're seeing it now is more the dropping of eligibility criteria, where you maybe perhaps had to have a 2-1 or a first before, and many firms are now offering access to people with a 2-2 and above.
Yep. And if you were an employer, what would you do to try and secure staff in Mark McGill Enterprises?
I think a lot of firms are doing a lot of the right things. Perhaps it's maybe just a question of publicising them. You know, we sort of touched briefly earlier just about NHS waiting lists and how valuable then, particularly for people with families, access to a private healthcare plan would be. Many firms offer this already. Make sure you advertise that as part of your recruitment process. Same with pensions. Many firms, well, all firms now legally have to offer a pension, but there's huge diversity in how generous those pension schemes are. So if you offer a generous one, make sure you state that in your job advertisement. State what percentage of salary the employer contribution is, because those things are an increasingly attractive offer to employees. What comes through with younger people, what's attractive from some of the survey evidence we have, is in and around training and development opportunities. And what we know from the labour force survey data is Northern Ireland is not good compared to other UK regions in terms of the proportion of people that are involved in lifelong learning activities. So firms that are offering, say, offering to help fund different types of courses would be very attractive to some young people coming through. Another area is help with childcare. We know how expensive childcare is. Some firms offer to help their employees with things like that. So I think just in general, what we would do in Mark McGill PLC or whatever we're calling it, is just to look at what's important to employees and start to make sure we sell ourselves in the appropriate way.
But overall, one of the key challenges is the fact that we've got the demographic dividend is no longer there that was previously the case. No longer as attractive to EU nationals than was previously the case as well. So one of the key problems is just going to be that we are going to have shortages. And do you just see that is going to continue indefinitely, where we're going to be in this, employers are going to be fighting and chasing after the same staff, and it's those with the biggest profits and sort of bank balances are going to secure the staff?
In the short term, I think it's going to ease a little bit just due to the demand side. We're facing challenging economic headwinds over the next 2 years, and I think we'll start to see a fall in the number of advertised vacancies just as a result of challenging business conditions for firms. But on the supply side, over the longer term, you know, this is largely a demographic issue. And if we look forward, the trouble we're experiencing at the minute is because we've experienced slower growth in the working age population over the last 10 years. Over the next 10 years, we're basically going to experience no growth in the working age population. But over the following two decades after that and beyond, the working age population starts to fall. So there'll be less people in absolute terms. It becomes no longer a problem of not having a growing working age population anymore. You have a falling working age population. And I think if you look at the latest government projections, if you look 30 years into the future, it indicates that there'll be around 80,000 less people of working age. And that can only lead to increased competition within the labour market.
And of course, that shrinking working age population is going to have to support a ever-growing pensioner population and all the healthcare costs, additional healthcare costs which come with that. And then just finally, Mark, let's assume Stormont is back up and running. What policies would you focus on to try and address the skills gaps or labour shortages?
Okay, so first of all, in the numbers game of just how can you increase the number of people, so you've got your two options. You have let's change what's happening with the natural increase, which is around increasing the birth rate. And you start to see various sort of naff policies from around the globe of people trying to do this. You know, the Soviets used to dish out a motherhood medal for anyone who had more than three children. The Singaporeans have a national night where they encourage their citizens to do their national duty in one particular night a year in order to boost the birth rate. The Japanese have state-sponsored speed dating nights, and there's various financial incentives. None of these work. None of them have worked anywhere these places have tried. I mean, it's nice that they've tried some of these things, but they don't work. So then you have to say, well, we don't have an option to change natural increase. You just have to look at migration. So then I would want
Although on the natural increase, it's, as you mentioned earlier about childcare, that some of the statistics I saw in the last couple of weeks were that the UK has the most expensive childcare of any of the kind of G7 and some other OECD countries. And clearly that acts as a deterrent, and we'll probably see change on that belatedly in the coming years.
Yeah, I know. I think there will be change on that. I don't see it as a mechanism to significantly raise participation, though. I think I see it more as a mechanism to ease financial pressures on households that have children, because the employment rates of people that have children are already very, very high. But to get back to the question, which was around policies, I would just prefer to have some flexibility locally to be able to make our own decisions in terms of migration, to provide the option there, to provide some sort of option to deviate from what UK policy is. Your other methods of boosting supply are around maximising what we've already got. You have to maximise the participation amongst the existing 16 to 64 population. So you have to look at the biggest groups then. So we talked about long-term sickness earlier. So we kind of look at them and think, well, how could we improve the participation rates among them? I think most of that group are on a sort of what I would call a passive benefit. You know, they receive a out-of-work sickness benefit. There's no there isn't conditionality applied. We have to do work initiatives. So they fall through the cracks of policy support in that area. And you have to think of, well, they probably don't really, many of that group probably don't go anywhere near a job centre. So let's provide some services to help people get back into work near to things where they actually go, whether it's beside a GP surgery, near your local library, whatever. So that could be one of many routes. You know, long-term sickness is a complicated problem and there's no one solution to it. I would also look at the groups who are the biggest groups that are amongst what I call the hidden unemployed. Yeah. So the hidden unemployed are the economically inactive who say that they want to work. And there's about twice as many of those as there are unemployed people. So it's a reasonable size of group and a very high proportion of them are disabled. So I would try and look at, you know, having an action plan for improving employment rates among the disabled. And again, complex issue requires cuts across multiple areas of policy, from health, from welfare, to infrastructure, to skills, and requires buy-in from multiple government departments. But given the number of people there and the fact that Northern Ireland has by far the lowest disabled employment rate within the UK, it's an area where we could do much better, and that would provide an additional supply of labour for us.
Okay, that's great. Thanks very much, Mark. That was Mark McGill, Senior Economist with Ulster University's Economic Policy Centre. So while the current political impasse isn't a source of joy, Northern Ireland can take pride for two achievements during February. Ross White, a film director from Belfast, won a BAFTA for his film An Irish Goodbye. The short film could see more success in Hollywood in March, as the film has been tipped for an Oscar as well. Fingers crossed. Meanwhile, Macrofelt-born international fashion designer Jonathan Anderson, son of former rugby international Willie Anderson and my former school teacher, he also hit the headlines in February. Rihanna's red outfit for the Super Bowl halftime show was designed by the former Rainy and Dowd pupil. It is not the outfit that anyone could carry off in Macrofelt, but both Ross's and Jonathan's achievements highlight the creative talent from people in this part of the world. So what is February's incoming economic data telling us? According to the PMI, both business activity and incoming orders fell for their ninth successive month in January, although the rates of decline did slow. But there were also signs of improvement and pockets of optimism. Input costs and output price inflation eased to two-year lows, albeit they remain at elevated levels. Employment growth accelerated to a six-month high, with all four sectors increasing staffing levels in January. This suggests that local firms are hoarding labour, and given the difficulty in recruiting staff and widespread shortages. Retail was a star performer in January with an increase in sales, and that rebound is perhaps surprising given the cost of living crisis. Two factors are likely to be driving this. Unlike Northern Ireland and the UK, the Republic of Ireland is neither in nor flirting with recession, and cross-border shopping is providing valuable support. During the second half of January, the £600 energy grant also started arriving with households, and in some instances, this subsidy, in part at least, is finding its way into the tills of local retailers. The extreme pessimism reported in 2022 appears to have lifted as well for local firms, who are the most optimistic in 9 months. It's only construction firms that are expecting further falls in output in 12 months' time. Most of Northern Ireland's labour market headlines continue to move in the right direction. January saw another record high in the number of employees on NI payrolls. Meanwhile, there have only been 4 months when unemployment has been lower than the current 2.5% rate. Encouragingly, Northern Ireland has posted the largest rise in payrolls of all 12 UK regions over the year to January this year, and also since the pandemic. But worryingly, however, Northern Ireland has also recorded the lowest rise in median earnings across the UK over both periods. And indeed, if we look at last month's January figures revealed a 3.9% year-on-year increase, which compares to a 10.1% annual rise in inflation. That's a whopping 6.2% fall in real terms. Ouch. Inflation has eased from October's 41-year low to the 10.1% last year. The largest contributor to this was transport, with the likes of petrol and diesel prices falling. But food prices are still rising at their fastest pace since 1977 at 16.8% year on year. And we've seen the likes of olive oil up 45%, potatoes and pasta up 20%, eggs 29%, and low fat milk 45%. Some good news though, that almost a year ago, wheat prices hit a record high after the Ukraine-Russian invasion. They're now back below pre-invasion levels, and the wider global food price index has hit a 16-month low in January and is down 18% from the peak last March. Petrol prices have also fallen in the UK, and they're 23% lower than their peak last year, with diesel down 15%. It has been a case of one-way traffic for local residential prices over the last 4 years or so, but Northern Ireland's residential property prices turned a corner with a 0.5% quarter-on-quarter decline in the fourth quarter last year. Despite this blip, the standardised price of property in the fourth quarter stood at £175,200, and that was 10.2% higher than a year ago, so broadly in line with inflation. It's also still up 25% since the start of the pandemic. New bills also bucked the wider trend, edging higher, albeit by the smallest of margins. And given rising mortgage rates and spiralling energy costs, the lure of a fixer-upper for first-time buyers looks rather less appealing. Looking at residential transactions over the last year, they fell in 2022 by 17%. And looking at the start of 2023 in January, they were down 22% relative to the same month last year. And the latest figures were the fewest number of residential property transactions in the last 31 months. Residential property prices may have started to fall, but rents for many are on the rise. In one segment of the rental sector, the Northern Ireland Housing Executive, it's set to increase rents for its 85,000 tenants by 7% from April this year. It's worth remembering rents have been frozen in 5 of the last 7 years. It is also worth noting 78% of Housing Executive tenants, which are those in receipt of housing assistance, they will be protected from the increase. But for the 18,000 who won't be shielded, this equates to a rise of £4.86 pence per week. And it will take the average weekly rent for a Housing Executive property to just over £74. A £5 a week increase may not sound a lot, but recent research by the Consumer Council revealed that Northern Ireland's lowest earning households, which are the bottom 20%, in the third quarter of last year, that their discretionary income after all essential bills, such as food, housing, and energy, etc., were paid, they had less than £20 per week to live on. It is not just housing demand that is falling, housing supply is too. And what with supply chain disruption and the soaring cost of building materials, house builders have had more uncertainty and volatility than usual. Northern Ireland housing starts fell by 10% year on year in the final quarter of last year, and it was the weakest fourth quarter in 8 years. Some 6,600 dwellings were started in 2022, looking at the year as a whole. That's down 12% on 2021 levels and is 9% below 2019, which was the pre-pandemic level. Outside of the pandemic low of 2020, 2022 was also the weakest year for starts since 2014. This will filter through into fewer house completions in due course, and last year saw an 8% annual fall in finished dwellings, which was a 6-year low. this trend looks set to continue in 2023. So what about the outlook? And looking in ahead into March, Jeremy Hunt will deliver his second fiscal event as Chancellor with a budget on the 15th of March. It is expected to be a rather tame affair following his debut last autumn. Hunt reversed most of the fiscal pyrotechnics that were part of the Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng not-so-many budget. The economic and fiscal outlook has improved since the OBR's last verdict. Falling gas prices and better-than-expected tax revenues should provide some wiggle room for some modest giveaways. I expect the planned 12p hike in fuel duty will be scrapped, and the planned lowering of the energy price guarantee, which will lead to increased energy costs, it may be delayed by a few months. But the pre-election giveaway budget will not happen next month. It will come further down the line, either in November or in March next year. Financial markets have not fully priced in another 25 basis points interest rate hike by the Bank of England on the 23rd of March. But we do expect the MPC will raise rates for an 11th successive meeting to 4.25%. In our view, this will mark the peak in the current interest rate cycle. Despite the UK PMI showing a return to growth in February, Northern Ireland's private sector is expected to see a 10th consecutive monthly decline in business activity, but we could well see a further improvement in business sentiment for the year ahead. Also, it'll be important to see, potentially within the budget, if there's any further funding for public sector workers. Will we see an acceptable pay offer given to some of the key public sector workers to stave off strikes? And how will this impact on Northern Ireland? Finally, will he, won't he? Will Joe Biden visit Northern Ireland ahead of the 25th anniversary and encourage a resumption of the dormant Stormont executive? In many ways, this will be perhaps dependent on what the reaction is to the emerging Northern Ireland Protocol deal and how the DUP in particular react to that. On previous occasions, a return to Stormont was accompanied by a financial package to sweeten the deal. Will we even see Mr. Biden throw some dollars in a fund for Northern Ireland's economic development needs? Perhaps it could be a happy anniversary after all. Until next time, I'm Richard Ramsay, and this was episode 25 of the Ulster Economics Podcast. Unhappy Anniversary with Mark McGill, Senior Economist at Ulster University's Economic Policy Centre. You can stay up to date by following us on social media and the ulstereconomics.com blog.